everyone. Welcome to China Money Podcast, a weekly in-depth interview show on private equity, venture capital, and hedge fund investments in China. I'm your host, Nina Xiang. Every week, I talk to a Chinese fund manager, a limited partner, or an industry expert. We discuss strategies, industries, opportunities, and challenges investing in Chinese markets. To get our program, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or go to our website, chinamoneypodcast.com, and sign up to our newsletters. You can also like our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at China Money Pod. Our guest today is Arthur Krober, founding partner of Beijing-based research boutique Dragonomics since 2002. The firm was bought in 2007 by Hong Kong-based research company GavCao. Arthur now manages GavCao Dragonomics research efforts in China and globally. Previously, he has lived and worked in Asia since 1987 and has been a journalist covering economic affairs in Asia. He's also a fellow of the Brookings Tsinghua Center in Beijing. He talked to me yesterday in Beijing on Monday, August 5th, about how he's less optimistic about China's growth in the next couple of years, why the alarmist headlines about capital outflows from China is overdone, and why 7% minimum growth rate that everyone talks about as the slowest rate for Chinese economic growth is total nonsense. But before we go to interview, please go to our website, chinamoneynetwork.com, for more daily updated news on the economy, Chinese investment news, expert columns, and latest alternative investment fund news. Lastly, remember, do support us by supporting our sponsors. Simply click our sponsors and advertisers ads on our website at chinamoneynetwork.com. Here's my conversation with Arthur Krober. Hope you enjoy it. Hi, Arthur. Welcome.
Hi, glad to be here.
In the past couple of weeks, there has been some media reports about concerns of a capital outflow from China. We have some headlines, such as one from Wall Street Journal, foreign capital outflows hit China in June. A Bloomberg story, China one-year swap rate rises on capital outflow concerns. And the most frightening of all, the UK's Telegraph article titled China braces for capital flight and debt stress as the Fed tightens. How concerned are you about a potential capital outflow or even a capital flight out of China?
Well, I'm not terribly concerned for two reasons. One is that the government still maintains pretty significant capital controls, and while you can evade these controls in various ways, it does mean that the government has the ability to regulate large-scale flows if it seems like there's a giant problem. And there's been some talk that they might reduce or eliminate those controls within the next couple of years, but I think that's pretty unlikely. But the broader point is that China's a big economy, and we've been used to having just one-way capital flows for a long time because it was going through this gigantic investment boom and a big property boom. And so everyone wanted to get their money into China, and no one wanted to take it out. And that's actually a fairly unusual situation. Most economies have flows going both ways. And in fact, many people for many years said that it was a big problem, not just for China, but for the rest of the world, that China was kind of like a Hotel California for capital, and you could check in, but you couldn't check out. Now we seem to be seeing more volatility in the flows. We've seen higher and lower levels of capital inflows over the last few years. We've seen reserve accumulation slow down quite dramatically, and as you mentioned recently, we've now seen some net capital outflows. But I think that's just part of the normal process of readjusting the Chinese economy from one that was growing incredibly fast on the basis of investment-intensive growth to one where it's growing slower and more of the growth is coming from consumer activity. So that means that the returns on investment just aren't so great. So it's natural for some people to want to take capital out.
Your answer is a very firm no to
right.
the question whether there will be a capital outflow or a significant capital outflow out of China. But let's look at this issue just a little bit more in detail. So let's talk about the capital control measures that China has right now in place for institutions and also for individuals. What kind of capital control measures that China have now?
Well, the simplest is that it's really almost impossible for Chinese individuals and very difficult for Chinese institutions to take money out of China and put it in a foreign stock market or a bond market. So portfolio outflows are highly regulated. and limited under the Qualified Domestic Institutional Investor Program, which sets an annual limit on how much portfolio outflows you can have. Now, again, there's ways for people to get around that through private banking products and so forth, and a lot of rich Chinese set up accounts in Hong Kong, and they get money over there by one way or another. So I think what we're likely to see over the next 2 years is that those controls will be relaxed gradually, and hopefully it over time, what it does is it creates a better balance between capital inflows and capital outflows. So I think clearly we are already seeing significant outflows of Chinese capital. We've seen them for several years through big Chinese companies going out to do mergers and acquisitions or greenfield investments internationally.
You would call that significant?
It's fairly significant. The outward foreign direct investment flows are pretty large scale now. I mean, they were not significant 5 years ago. Now they run on the order of, I think, somewhere between $50 and $80 billion a year. And so that's a meaningful amount of money. But the point is that if capital starts to go out from China, either through direct investment or through portfolio investment, that's just normal. There's nothing wrong with that. The only issue is if people lose confidence in the economy and then everyone decides to take their money out. That's a very remote possibility because the Chinese economy basically is doing all right. So it really wouldn't make sense for people to take their money out. And the other thing is that there's no sense that the currency is overvalued. So if you look at other countries that have experienced capital flight, usually it's because they're running a very unbalanced economy with very high risks, or they have a currency that's overvalued, and so it's very cheap for people to go and buy assets abroad. Right? And neither of those criteria really apply to China. So capital outflows are fine, and China can sustain a lot more of them without that being a problem. Capital flight, in the sense that it's dangerous, it's just not very probable at all.
But that doesn't stop the media from using the term. And mm-hmm. when we see the word, we remember the Asian financial crisis right. in 1997. There is probably very little similarity between what has happened in China in the last couple of months to the situation in 1997. But in one measure, foreign debt to GDP ratio, back in 1997, in some countries, this ratio was 100% to 160-70%. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe just talk a little bit more about what are some elements that caused the Asian financial crisis
right.
that's not existent in China right now?
Well, I mean, I think the reason that some people are concerned about China is they look at it and they say, look, it's had incredibly high investment rates for a very long period of time. And that was also true of the Asian financial crisis countries like Thailand, Malaysia, South Korea, and Indonesia. Now, so what China has is an economy that's relied for a long time on a very high level of investment, and a lot of that has been in property. I think the people who look at this from the outside have good reasons to be a little bit concerned, because on the surface, you have a very similar set of phenomena in China over the last 2 years as you did in the Asian economies in 1997 and in Japan in the late 80s. But I think the differences are, first of all, the Asian economies in the 90s were mainly running current account deficits. China's running a very sustained current account surplus. The Asian economies did a lot of external borrowing, and China basically has no external borrowing. Some of the real estate developers have done a little bit of borrowing in dollars. And so the overall, you know, the external debt ratio is very low. And then the final point is that the domestic financial system has a lot of liquidity and a fairly diversified spread of assets. So you can't have a crisis triggered by the foreign creditors calling in their loans and going away, because there are no foreign creditors. And it's very, very difficult to see a crisis emerging from a domestic liquidity problem, because liquidity in the banking system is still very, very strong. So that's why I think that some of the more alarmist headlines about, you know, capital flight or financial system collapse are overdone. I think there are real concerns, though, because the economy does need to make a transition. The investment rate has been too high, and the return on investment in many, many sectors has been going down very dramatically. So there is a real problem with making capital as productive as it ought to be in China, and that is not, it's not a small problem, it's a big problem.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the economic development model shift soon, but just last question about the capital outflow issue. What would make you become worried maybe 5 years, 10 years down the road?
Right. Well, the concerns I would have would be twofold. One is on the domestic front, if you see a continued rapid increase in the ratio of credit to GDP, then I would be very, very concerned that the foundations of growth in China were just not sustainable. And so then you would have a risk that there would be a real dramatic slowdown in economic growth sometime in the next 2 years, and that certainly one impact of that could be to encourage many Chinese people to take their money out and put it somewhere else. At the moment, the government seems pretty determined to rein in credit and stabilize the credit to GDP ratio.
Credit to GDP ratio can have different definitions.
So in Dragonomics, we create a credit to GDP ratio based on bank loans plus our estimate of the net lending in the shadow financing sector.
Oh, okay.
The problem is that in shadow banking, there's a gross number which is very high, but that may include some intermediate steps between the originator of the loan and the ultimate borrower. So we try to estimate, you know, broadly what the true credit exposures are. You know, it's a little bit of a rule of thumb. We can't be extremely precise, but we can, I think, basically see whether the trajectory is very steeply up, roughly stable, or coming down. And what I would like to see over the next year or two is that ratio should stabilize and then hopefully come down over time. And if that happens, then I think the risk of some kind of systemic financial crisis is pretty low. The second thing is really more policy related, and as I indicated, it's really very, very difficult now to get capital flight because of the capital controls. There has been a lot of talk by the government that maybe they will reduce or eliminate capital controls, you know, in 2 or 3 years. And in fact, the People's Bank has been, you know, pretty outspoken about indicating that they think that it's perfectly reasonable to reduce or eliminate capital controls.
Which you don't agree.
I question that, because China is, at the same time that they're trying to sort of normalize the capital flows, you know, inward and outward, they're also trying to liberalize the domestic financial system and liberalize interest rates. Domestic interest rate reform is a very delicate process, and there's a lot of international experience that suggests that when you liberalize particularly deposit interest rates, that can cause a lot of problems, because then you get a lot of competition between banks offering higher and higher rates. They then have to go out and chase higher and higher returns, and they often get into trouble. Ideally, if you're a developing country, while you're doing that liberalization of the domestic financial sector, you keep a pretty tight rein on the capital account, so that if there is a problem in the domestic financial sector, basically it can be contained. So I would be a little bit concerned if there was a decision to eliminate capital controls in the next 2 years. Again, at the end of the day, I don't think that the senior leaders would accept that, because they would view the risk as too high.
I think I remember hearing some economists from the IMF also mentioning that
right.
The roadmap of China's financial reform should follow a step with the capital control loosening, the last one. So
that's right.
That should be done as
right.
a final step.
That's fairly orthodox prescription. I think one of the reasons that you're seeing this debate in China is that the reformers, who are very anxious to get domestic financial liberalization going, they found it very frustrating, because there's a lot of political opposition to that. And I think part of their strategy has been to use capital account mechanisms as a way to kind of force the domestic conversation towards a reform direction. So, for example, if you look at the decision to set up an offshore renminbi market in Hong Kong, I think the logic behind that partly was if you create market-driven interest rates for renminbi in Hong Kong, that will eventually force a convergence of onshore interest rates, which are set by the government, with the market-driven rates in Hong Kong. I think that was part of the rationale for doing that. My suspicion is that that's what's going on, and for that reason, I think that we'll continue to hear talk about capital account liberalization, because that's an important weapon in the reformers' arsenal to keep talking about that. But my suspicion is that the action will be constrained because the political leadership just is not willing to take that risk.
That's very interesting. But let's move on to the economy. You just mentioned a little bit about how the unbalanced economy development model should be shifted towards more consumer-driven. How much do you buy into this? Don't you think currently, already in the past year, investment already below 50% contribution to the GDP, mm-hmm. we're already seems to be seeing the unbalanced economy is on a natural path to becoming more balanced?
Well, I think this is it's kind of an intricate question that is often subject to simplifications. So the first comment I'd make is that it's not like China has to stop investing. Okay, it's still a developing country. The overall capital stock, so the total amount of infrastructure and housing and industrial plant and so forth, is still on a per capita basis significantly lower than it would be in any developed economy. An enormous amount of very large scale investments that China still needs to make legitimately over the next 20 years, and that will generate very high returns. And then I think the other point is that it's very, very difficult for an economy at this level of income and with this kind of entrenched pattern of development to suddenly shift, turn into a kind of United States-style consumer economy. That just is not realistic. So it's a transition that occurs over a very long period of time. I think it's very, very clear that in some ways this transition has already begun. So the first indication that we saw of this is that one aspect of the booming investment economy was that you had a huge increase in the Chinese trade surplus from 2002 to 2007. And that has gone away. So the current account peaked in 2007 at around 10% of GDP. It's come down to about 2 or 2.5% of GDP, and it seems to have stabilized about that level. So that was the first rebalancing, if you will, from an economy that was too reliant on exports to one that has a better balance between exports and domestic demand. So similarly, I think you look at the domestic economy and you say, well, you need to rely a bit more on consumption, a bit less than on investment. We've seen the investment share of GDP basically level off. It's not really going down. And I think we can reasonably expect that it will stay at a pretty high level for many years to come. But it probably won't grow that much. I think the more important thing is just to look at what is the relative growth rates of investment and consumption. You know, from 2000 to 2010, investment was growing in real terms about 15% a year, and personal consumption was growing at probably around 8 or 9% a year. And I think what we're likely to see, what we've seen already, is that both of those growth rates are going to come down a bit. So the investment growth rate is probably now running only at about 6 or 7% a year, something like that. And the consumption growth rate has come down from 8 or 9% in real terms to something a little bit lower than that. And I guess the final point I would make is you kind of remarked that there was a natural rebalancing going on, and I don't think it's totally natural. I think an awful lot of policy support. And one of the biggest is that the previous government had a habit of pumping up investment spending anytime there was a little bit of a dip in the economy. And the current government has made it very clear that they're not going to do that. And instead, what they've started to try and do is make changes in the tax structure to encourage people to focus more on service enterprises as opposed to manufacturing or infrastructure.
The new government leadership has been in place for about 6 months now. Mm-hmm. What's your general reading of the directions that they're likely to take the economy in the future?
Well, it's a little hard to tell because so far we've seen a lot of talk and not that much specific action. I think the new government has made it pretty clear, as I mentioned, that they're not simply going to have an automatic stimulus policy. That's good. I think they've made it pretty clear, partly through that action on the interbank market in June, that credit is not going to be so easy to come by as in the past, and so they're going to start reining in credit growth. We've seen some tax changes, as I mentioned. So basically one thing that's very noticeable is that the business tax that used to be levied on a wide range of service enterprises is now being converted into a value-added tax. This was originally piloted in a couple of localities and a couple of sectors, but now it's being broadly applied across most of the country. And the net effect of that is it's a tax cut. And it's a tax cut that essentially benefits service companies in particular. So hopefully that will incentivize more investment there. And then the other thing that they've talked about, they've talked about two other things. One is this urbanization policy, which maybe we can get back to later, because I think, first of all, it's not 100% clear what's going to be in there. But I think that's also been a little bit misunderstood. It's not really a building program so much as a program to, over the long term, support urban household incomes. The other is they've talked a lot about various kinds of deregulatory measures to reduce red tape, make it easier to register business, enable private companies to enter more sectors. And again, we don't have too many details on this. So if they can actually do that, then that would be very positive.
From what you just said, it seems like, I guess, your projections of the Chinese economy's growth in the next couple of years are also one that's more moderate growth, maybe around 7%.
Or even less.
Or even less?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the next couple of years are very tricky. And so, historically, I've tended to be on the more optimistic. Right now, I think most of the market forecasters still are assuming that China will grow by 7.5% or so next year. And I frankly think that's very unlikely. I think it's going to be more like 6 or 6.5%. And the reason is that the government is, on one hand, trying to reduce credit growth, at the same time do some structural reforms that probably in the short term will have the impact of forcing certain companies to go out of business or to reduce their operations. So you put these two things together, and it's very, very difficult to see how the current rate of growth, which is barely 7% if you look on a sequential basis, it's very hard to see how that can be sustained. If the government is serious about doing the right things, keeping credit under control and starting some structural reforms, then I think you've got a couple of years where growth is going to be, by Chinese standards, fairly weak, certainly under 7%. And my bet would be for next year it'll be 6 to 6.5, and the year after it could be something quite similar to that.
But then 7% is a minimum that many economists say that's going to keep the employment that's needed for the new graduates from
university. Yeah, but see, that was never true, and it's even less true now than it ever was. You know, that 7% number that everyone talks about, first of all, there's no other economy in the world in history that has had to maintain that high level of growth in order to develop and employ its people. So if that was true for China, you have to ask what was wrong here that wasn't wrong in other economies that have done perfectly fine with much lower levels of growth. Okay? But then if you look back as to when did people start talking about this minimum 7%, it was basically in the late 90s and early 2000s. And at that time, two things were happening. First of all, the government was slashing tens of millions of jobs in the state sector. So lots and lots of workers were basically being thrown out into the market. The other thing is that the population of young people was expanding very dramatically. So every year you had more and more young people entering the market. So yeah, in those days, it was very, very difficult to grow fast enough to generate enough jobs to absorb all of these people. Today, the situation is completely different. State-owned enterprises are net employers. They're not laying people off. And, probably more important, the number of young people entering the workforce each year is shrinking. So the first point is that you simply don't need to create the same number of jobs now that you did 10 years ago. You can create a lot less jobs, and everything will be fine. The second point is that the structure of GDP is much more important than the level when you're trying to figure out how many jobs are being created. So if I am a local government, say, and I have a choice between policies that will create, 10,000 little retail stores and shops and service enterprises, or I can just build one big aluminum smelter, what do the local governments in China do? They just build one big aluminum smelter. And maybe the GDP growth that they can record from each one is the same, but if the aluminum smelter, there's maybe 2,000 jobs. And if you create all of this welter of small enterprises, you might have five times as many jobs. GDP growth is the same, but the employment impact is very different. So this whole notion that you have to have some specific level of growth to generate the number of jobs, I think is just completely nonsensical. You know, if China grows next year by 6 or 6.5%, but the structure of growth improves and is more service-oriented, more consumer-business-oriented, then there's absolutely no problem in creating all the jobs that China needs at a much lower level of growth.
That's a great point. And lastly, your forecast for the economy for the next few years, 7%, maybe 6.5%. What does that mean for investors? A lot of our audience are professional investors looking for investment opportunities in China. Where do you see as some attractive places for good investments?
So historically, when there was a big booming investment-driven economy, what people tended to do was that they bought stocks that were beneficiaries of the investment boom, so construction machinery, materials companies, and if you had ways of playing the real estate game, which you often could through private equity deals and so forth, then that was a very, very good way to gain growth. But the large majority of China-related stocks, you could spend a lot of time in them and not make very much money. And I think we have a similar problem today, which is that all of the traditional investment proxies, like the materials companies, construction equipment companies, these guys are getting killed, so you don't want to be there. Stocks that kind of tended to be viewed as proxies for economic growth, like the banks sometimes, are also very problematic. And then if you look at the consumer sector, which is where you're getting, you know, still very robust growth in a lot of sectors, the listed companies are mostly terrible. They're mostly old-fashioned business models. The one that everyone likes at the moment, obviously, is the whole internet and online commerce. My suspicion is that they'll continue to be bid up until Alibaba does its IPO, which is probably going to be next year, and that will probably be a blockbuster deal that a lot of people will get into. And then I think the question will be, do you still see momentum behind the Chinese internet sector, or does that sort of mark the peak of the bubble? But it's a real problem, because basically the companies that are best placed to take advantage of the expanding consumer markets are either not big enough yet to be of interest, or they're not listed yet, so you can't get access to them, or they are listed and they're incredibly overpriced. So I don't think there's actually an easy answer to that question, unfortunately.
That's still very helpful. Thank you so much, Arthur.
Okay, my pleasure.